I'm Jason Mundock, and this is Around the Wood Stove, a podcast showcasing the arts. In this episode, I welcome Chet Williamson to the Wood Stove House. Chet is a Lancaster County native who has had a successful career as an author, actor, and musician. He recently embarked on a new journey, recording and releasing audio and ebook versions of some of his novels. We discussed how these relatively new technologies are changing the book publishing industry and how Chet's creative life has evolved and continues to evolve over the years. To learn more about Chet, visit chetwilliamson.com. And for show notes and to hear other episodes of the podcast, visit the Wood Stove House online at woodstovehouse.com and click podcast. Well, joining me in the Wood Stove House is Chet Williamson. I'm going to call you a Renaissance man.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. Thanks.
You're an award-winning author, professional actor, musician. But I would like to start first with your writing career. Mm-hmm. You published 25 books, yeah. Over 100 short stories, mostly in the genre of horror and fantasy, if I'm correct?
Yes, mm-hmm. Some mystery stuff.
So tell us about the first story you sold almost 30 years ago, 1981. Yeah. Right. What was that experience like?
That was still the greatest. I mean, I belonged to an amateur press association, which was actually in connection with H.P. Lovecraft. We were all fans of Lovecraft. But every once in a while, I would write a little piece of really bad fiction and include it. Because, you know, it was like there were maybe 30 members, and each member would do, 30 copies of his magazine. And then we'd send them all to the official editor, and then he would send one of each out to everybody. So I had a few stories in there, but I started writing some other stories that I figured, yeah, maybe I could submit this. And I submitted that story to the Twilight Zone magazine, which Ted Klein, T.E.D. Klein, who is known as a writer. He's written maybe two or three novels and some novellas and very few short stories. But he's got a very small body of work, but he's a wonderful writer. And Ted was editing Twilight Zone at the time. And I sent this story to him. And the first reaction I got was, I really like this story. I don't think I'm going to use it for the magazine. I was like, But then he called me and said, that story really stays with me. And he said, I'd really like to use it. So this was fairly late in the evening, and my son was just a kid then, a little kid, like 3 or 4 years old. Mm-hmm. And he was in his crib and sleeping, and my wife was at symphony rehearsal or something. I didn't have anybody to share it with, so basically I just giggled in the kitchen insanely for a long, long time and fell down on the floor and did the curly shuffle,
right.
Ran around the kitchen floor. And that was just that feeling that, wow, somebody is actually willing to pay money for something that you made up. That was the greatest. And, I've had a lot of really fun things happen since, but that first sale, I don't think there's anything that can ever take the place of that.
It's a long time ago now. Has your approach changed in the way you write fiction?
Yeah, I've gotten a lot lazier. in those days, I used to go and write 2 pages a day. Usually during my lunch hour, I would work on it, and if I didn't finish, I would come home at night and work until I wrote 2 pages. And at the end of the year, I had almost over 700 pages.
Right.
Mostly short stories.
So you were very disciplined.
I really was, yeah. And then once I started freelancing full time, I tried to boost that up to 6 pages a day. And for a long time, I really, stayed at that level. I would write a novel a year, along with a number of short stories and other things. But I don't know, as things progressed and as the markets, the market for the kind of fiction I was writing, which was mostly horror, kind of disappeared in the early 90s. There was a flood of it, and the good stuff mixed with the bad stuff, and it just kind of tainted the whole market. So I wrote less. I found myself writing less and less. And I did a few work-for-hire projects, which is where people come to you or your agent comes to you and says, hey, they want you to write a Crow novel, based on the series The Crow. And I did 2 of those. I did a couple of novels for TSR. which were fun, you know, they were fun. And another one for another a novelization of a video game that nobody remembers anymore. In like 1995 or 96, it was called Hell, a cyberpunk thriller.
Oh.
And the voice, it was a great game. The voices, among the people who did the voices, were like Dennis Hopper and Grace Jones. And it was a real hoot. But so I did one of those. And finally it got to the point where I decided I'm not doing this anymore. And didn't. And
the work for hire.
The work for hire stuff. And, you know, I suppose I could have. It was a way to make some money. But I just felt that it was kind of a dead end. Although a lot of my friends still do it. And they've, a lot of them have been very successful at it because it's opened a lot of doors for them. Readers recognize their name from, I mean, a number of my friends have written like Buffy novels.
Okay.
And a wonderful writer and friend of mine, Elizabeth Massey, just, she just won a prize for the best novelization for writing The Tudors, the, was it Showtime series, I think. But she wrote a novelization of that. So, but it was just something I decided not to do, and I haven't done it since. And
so that would have been in the mid-90s?
Mid-90s. Right around there.
You're from Lancaster, I understand, originally.
Yeah, the area.
And have been here throughout a great majority of your writing career and your life.
Yeah.
How has living in Lancaster informed your writing career, your creative career, and do you see it as an advantage, a disadvantage, or both in some way?
I think it's always a case of you write what you know, and most of my novels really have been set in Lancaster, and around the area. The first novel I wrote was set in upstate Pennsylvania, but Ash Wednesday was really set in, was modeled after Elizabethtown.
Okay.
Really, I mean, if you know Elizabethtown and you read that book, you can say, oh yeah, I know, that's the blah, blah, blah. McCain's Dilemma, which was a mystery that I wrote, was set in Lancaster. It was Lancaster. And then in some other works I've done, I've taken Lancaster and fictionalized it as the city of Buchanan, Pennsylvania. But probably, actually, my best-selling book was informed totally by my being a Lancaster County boy, and that was the Pennsylvania Dutch Night Before Christmas, which was this silly poem that I wrote for my wife one Christmas after we had read A Cajun Night Before Christmas, and she had suggested doing a Pennsylvania Dutch version. And so I wrote that, and I mean, that thing is like, I think now in its seventh hardcover printing, and, you know, it came out in 2000, and every year it keeps selling. And I have run into so many people, you know, when they discover who I am, did you write that Pennsylvania Dutch Christmas book? I said, yeah, not the stuff that, you know, not the work that I spent a year, novel I spent a year writing, but the thing that I spent, you know, 2 days writing.
Yeah, but isn't that about how it goes? You know,
it is
that one thing that
you just never know. And I mean, and I'm delighted because I've had so many people tell me, you know, we read that in dialect every Christmas Eve to our family. Kids gather around, we read it, and we laugh every Christmas Eve. And I go, that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
actually, yeah, that's really fun.
Now, recently, you published or republished Ash Wednesday from originally published in 1987,
right?
As an ebook and an audiobook. What was the drive behind doing that, and for that particular book instead of something more current?
Yeah, I had a number of people who came to me and asked me if I was interested in doing ebooks, and I was, but the people who were asking me about it really weren't set up to do it. They were sort of getting, you know, trying to get people together, and then I think if they had enough, then they would go ahead and do it.
Oh, I see.
A fellow named David Niall Wilson came to me, who already had Crossroad Press established, and he was already selling ebooks. He knew how to do it. He was turning out audiobooks, and he asked me if I would be interested in letting him do my backlist. And the financial deal was really good. And David's a writer, so I think he probably is a bit more empathetic toward writers than a lot of people out there. And he had, you know, access to all ready to go into the Kindle store and everything else. So the thing that really sold me on it, though, was when he said he did audiobooks. And I said, well, you know, I said, I wouldn't mind reading audiobooks. He said, well, have you read any audio before? And I had, because there's a website called MPformance, MPFormance.com. And my friend and writer Andrew Vax helped to get this website started. And what they do is they sell MP3 performances. They're really well done. They have incidental music and sound effects and ambient sound and everything. So they're really like performances rather than just a straight reading. So I did several readings of some of Andrew's stories, and then they asked me to do some of my own, which I did, and they'll be up on the site fairly soon, I think. So I had those, and I said, hey, listen to these and see what you think. And so when he heard them, he said, I want you to do as many audiobooks as you would like to do with
great.
Your own books. So I did Ash Wednesday, and Lowland Rider is just up, just came out this week as an audiobook and an ebook. And I just agreed to do three of Michael Moorcock's, the fantasy writer, British fantasy writer's books. So it's a series that he did. It's called the Second Ether series. They were written in the mid-90s. So they're really interesting, really bizarre. So I'll be reading those in the next few weeks. A lot of horror writers sell to leisure books, Dorchester. They're most paperback originals is what they do. And I just found out yesterday that they are not going to be doing the regular rack size paperbacks anymore. They're only going to do trade paperbacks and ebooks. And the trade paperbacks may be done as print on demand. So it's a rough time for publishing, and I mean even the larger and more well-known publishers are really having trouble.
You know, the internet was supposed to destroy everything, mm-hmm. right? And it has done a good job on a lot of things.
Yeah,
you know, a lot of industries, but it just seemed like for the last 10 or 12 years that, you know, bookstores are packed mm-hmm. with people. But yeah. I wonder if it's now time, like it's where the internet is starting to really change that.
I don't know. But, you know, I think a lot of, well, for example, every time when I go into Barnes & Noble in Lancaster, mm-hmm. they've always got a good crowd.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But I just read this past week that Barnes & Noble is putting itself up for sale. And
really?
Yeah, and when you look at their sales, at the little graphs that their sales, it's like been going down, 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 down every year. Amazon, up, 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 up.
Okay.
Every year. And it's a shame because I love brick and mortar stores, you know? I
mean,
I just love them. You can go in there and, you know, actually see the book and hold it. And what Amazon offers with, oh, look inside the book.
Yeah.
And then you click and you can read pages from it. And that's cool, but it ain't as cool as picking that book up and holding it in your hands.
No, it's different.
I think the book industry has been lagging behind a little in other, like in music, everybody jumped to MP3s.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it's getting harder and harder to find actual physical CDs of things anymore. With books, you can still find the physical books. And the ebooks, the Kindle, the Nook, and everything else are, it's a constantly increasing market, and I think it's going to go in that direction in the next few years even stronger. And that was one reason why I wanted to get into ebooks at this point. I thought it was really time. 'Cause it's sad, but physical books are, they're never going to be non-existent. I cannot conceive of a future without the physical book. But I think there will be more and more people reading them on Kindles and other contraptions like that.
Do you have a Kindle?
I don't. I have, like, the only thing that I read stuff on is my iPhone because there's a Stanza.
Okay.
And they have tons of stuff that you can, like, download for free.
Mm-hmm.
But
public domain?
Yeah, public domain stuff primarily. And so I have a lot of stuff on there, but I don't really enjoy reading something on there. I was going back and forth reading Anna Karenina, And I was going back and forth between the physical book and on my iPhone. And it's like whenever I, like I'm in a line or something and I go, well, I could read a little Anna Karenina. But it's such, I don't know, it a 19th century Russian novel read on an iPhone just seems wrong. You know, and it's just like...
Yeah, there's something that doesn't jive
with
that.
I mean, iPhones are for reading tweets and 140-character messages and some Facebook statuses and things like that. But it's interesting. I was just listening when I was coming in here. They were interviewing a guy named Nicholas Carr, who's written a book called The Shallows, which is about how the internet is affecting the way that we think, the way that we put thoughts together and go from one thing to the next, and that there is no time, we don't have any time anymore. We're so used to multitasking and checking this and checking, you know, email, that to just sit and think or become engaged in a book or, you know, a long thoughtful article is slowly becoming a thing of the past, and our minds just are not working in that way anymore. And I find myself, I find that happening. You know, when I think about writing, it's like if I have an iPhone with me or if my computer's in the same room, it's like so easy just to go, oh, well, I'll think about it after I check
this, you know, and that,
this,
and
Facebook.
The other thing. You're very active on Twitter, on Facebook, and I personally have sort of gotten into that space in the last, we'll say, 2 weeks, where I'm questioning my participation.
Yeah, I know. It's just there's Twitter especially. Facebook, I still find kind of charming in a way and useful, but Twitter has just become such a miasma of clutter. There's just so much clutter, so many people saying things that really don't need to be said. I don't need to know that it's time for you to eat your lunch. I don't need to know that you have become mayor of Dorkland in Foursquare. You know, I'm like, why are you doing this? Why are you telling me this? Does this, do you think this has any interest for me at all? And, you know, every once in a while, I mean, I usually use Twitter to be snarky about something or to send a link that I think is important or, you know, a petition that people should look at and sign. And sometimes if I find myself, if I'm at a performing venue and I'm seeing a band that I'm really enjoying, I'll often take a picture and just tweet that. Send that out, watching so-and-so right now, because I want people to know about it, and I want people to know that this kind of music, you can hear this kind of music at this venue, and why don't you get up and listen to it, you know, because it's like, there's so much great music going on in Harrisburg, and most people in Lancaster will not take that, you know, 35, 40-minute drive to hear great music. Some will. But, you know, I beat people over the head with that. I'll say, hey, you know, this is happening right now, and there's a great venue. Appalachian Brewing Company has a new venue called The Gallery. It's like a listening room venue at the back of the second floor. And it's great. I saw the Wood Brothers up there the other week.
That's great to know, yeah.
They were just terrific. So,
what do you see, or how do you see Twitter or Facebook or any other sort of social media technology, where do you see the value from a business or promotional perspective?
You know, when I've begun using it in that way, when I had, like, when Ash Wednesday, the audiobook of my novel Ash Wednesday, when I brought that out, I would, like, every hour or so, I tweeted a quote from a review of the previous review of the book, and then put a link to the ebook and the thing. And I don't know if anybody actually paid any attention to it. I figure it can't hurt. But when that was over that day, I did it. And, you know, maybe I sent out a total of 8 tweets about it over a period of several hours. Mm-hmm. And that was it. You know, I thought, okay, I'm not going to do that again. Lowland Rider, another novel of mine, is coming out now. And I'll probably try the same thing with that.
From a writing perspective, if you think about music and the way that small studios and MP3s mm-hmm. and iTunes as a level playing field goes.
Right.
It doesn't actually translate to a level playing field, but that's the perception. So I can record a record in this room mm-hmm. and in my house, and I can sell it on iTunes tomorrow.
Right.
For worldwide distribution.
If it isn't lost amid
thousands. No one will buy it.
Right.
But I have the technology to make a record sound pretty good mm-hmm. and put it out there.
Right.
Are writers doing anything like that? Is self-publishing becoming a thing?
Yes, it is. There are a lot of writers who are taking their books and just turning them directly into e-books. Okay. And putting them out there. And I mean, and anybody can do it. You can get a book on Kindle. You know, okay. You just have to sign their agreement.
Like iTunes, then, for yeah. music. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And there are a number of other platforms for, to buy ebooks on. The formats are the same, but you can sell them through different platforms. It's like different retail stores, almost.
Okay.
You know, who will be selling these ebooks.
Was there a favorite? A favorite novel, a favorite short story. Is there something that stands out in your head? You say, you know, that's the one. It might not have sold the most, mm-hmm. but it's just something that you
actually. There's one right now that hasn't sold at all. It was called Nothing Man, and it has not been published to this point. It was purely Japanese. My son has lived in Japan for the past 10 years or so. He's in Seattle for 2 years now. But we went over to Japan several times, and I wrote a book. It's sort of a thriller crossed with a novel of character, and there's not an American character in it. They're all Japanese, which accounts for why it hasn't sold over here. I mean, I've had editors read it and tell me that they absolutely love it, and they have no idea of how to market it. Mm-hmm. But that one I like. Of my published books, I'd probably say Second Chance is the one that I'm probably happiest with. It's supposed to still be available in paperback. It was published in paperback by this company that now is only doing ebooks. So I don't know. We'll see what happens, what the fate of that one is. But it's available as used paperbacks and sure. It was done in hardcover originally. So there are copies out there.
Let's talk about theater.
Okay.
You started in theater.
Dude in my heart. I did. Yeah.
And talk about the sort of those early years and then sort of the theater path.
Sure. Well, I started doing theater in high school and college and did a ton of it then. And then when I got out of college, I taught school for a year, which was a terrible mistake for me, but taught me that I didn't want to do that anymore.
Huh? What did you teach?
I taught 7th and 8th grade, no, I'm sorry, 8th and 9th grade English in Shaker Heights in Cleveland, Ohio. And this is a cool trivia thing. In my 8th grade, gifted English class, I had Peter Ostrom, who played in the first Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. What was it called? It was Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Right, right.
Yeah, right. And a sweet, sweet kid. And he had made the film by then and had come back to Ohio and was just a normal kid. And he was. And, I mean, he never made another film. He's a veterinarian now.
Is that right?
Yeah. So that was kind of fun. So whenever I
that's
see
a neat
Willy
bit
Wonka,
of trivia, indeed.
Yeah, it is. But then I got involved in these industrials with Armstrong in Lancaster, and acted in them. And basically, they were musical comedies. They would be a full-length musical comedy for a convention, a flooring convention, or a ceiling convention, or a carpet convention, or anything that Armstrong made. Every division, they would have a separate, you know, musical. And we did song parodies. And
that's a little mind-blowing.
It was. It was really weird. But there were tons of actors who made their livings from that when would it have been? Late 70s, 80s, through the 80s, into the early 90s. And then business became a little more straight-laced, and we can't spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on fun anymore, you know, so.
It's... It's just mind blowing to think that they had they did that at all.
Yeah,
was that a
yeah.
common thing for business for corporations to
it
do?
It was. Most of the auto companies did industrial shows. In New York, there was a fabric company, Millikan Fabrics, and the Millikan show was the big industrial of the year, and that was held in Manhattan. And that was huge. But I mean, it was great because we got to go on the road. We'd go to Boca Raton and New Orleans and San Francisco to do these shows. So we got to travel. And
that's fascinating.
Yeah, it was really fun. And that's basically how I got started writing.
Okay.
And then I started writing short stories. Then once I started writing, I was out of theater. I freelanced. I continued to freelance write the Armstrong shows up until they died in the mid-90s. And didn't do any theater for a long time. Around 2004, got involved in the Lancaster Dramatist Platform, which a woman named playwright named Julianne Homake started when she was playwright in residence at FNM, Franklin and Marshall College, and got involved in that. We were reading each other's plays, and Julianne said, "Did you ever act?" I said, "Oh yeah, oh yeah." So she said, "Well, you know, you really should do that again. You'd be great for readings and stuff." So I did, and I got my Actors Equity card back again. Okay. Because I had been on temporary leave for about 30 years, so I had to pay a very small fee to get it back, and started doing some work for Theater of the Seventh Sister, and then the Fulton.
Right.
Yeah.
We saw you last year in two shows.
Oh, yeah?
Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Right.
And then part of the family series, The Nutcracker.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, yes, I was Uncle Drosselmeyer on The Nutcracker. Yeah. So it's fun.
What's sort of the vibe in Lancaster from a theater perspective? Is Lancaster considered a pretty good place, an okay place, or do people sort of lament and wish they were elsewhere?
No, it's okay. I mean, it's an okay theater place. Theater of the Seven Sister doesn't do as much as they used to. The Fulton is a nonprofit, but still they've got to keep going, and it's very difficult right now for theaters in general. So they have to do shows that people are going to want to come and see, which rules out a lot of edgier things. Things that I'd be more interested in doing. So they do a lot of musicals, and they are doing one original new play this year. They had a competition last year, and it sounds very interesting. I mean, a very serious play about contemporary, about the Russian mafia in the United States.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so I'm really anxious to see that. Apparently it's based on a Chekhov piece. I read a lot of the plays for the competition, but that was not one of the ones I've read. So I'm really anxious to see that. But there really are not a lot of places now where you can see or do classical theater and more edgy contemporary stuff. Like I'd love to do some Harold Pinter somewhere. And sort of along those lines, we've been trying to establish Creative Works of Lancaster to do new work, and hopefully in conjunction with Lancaster Dramatist Platform, which is the playwriting group that I've been involved with for about 6 years now.
Talk about that group, the Lancaster Dramatist Platform, and sort of what it's about and what it does, how people can get involved.
Okay. It started over at FNM, and then we moved over to the Fulton and met there for a while, and now it's actually back at FNM. We meet at Writer's House right now. But all the local theaters have been very supportive of it. Every 2 months, on every other first Friday, we do readings of new plays, usually shorter plays, in the Michael Mitchell Clubhouse behind the Fulton Theater. It's in Water Street. It's just right behind the theater.
Right.
At 9 o'clock, after all the galleries close and people are looking for something else to do. And usually it runs about an hour. And it's a great opportunity for the playwrights to hear their works with an audience, to see how the audience responds to the works. And it's just a great thing. And it's a nice thing for the theater community, too.
How long has Creative Works been in existence?
It's been in existence for about a year, and has sort of had a kind of a rough start, but we're trying to focus more and more now. You know, it's very hard for a new startup, especially an artistic startup, to get going in this economy. So we're at the point now where we have our 501c3 papers ready, finally, to turn in.
Okay.
We're planning some events. There's a musical event that we hope to have going in October. We definitely want to have at least one theater work this fall, and we're planning that. So, you know, we're getting there. It's taken a while.
What's the makeup of that organization? What's the sort of...
What we would like to do is we would like to do theater works, usually for small, we're talking intimate space here. You know, that's what we're looking for right now. We're trying to find a space that we could rent that would be somewhere between 1,500, 2,500 square feet would be ideal for the kind of thing that we want to do. We have a few places in mind right now. We're going to start fundraising once our tax exempt status comes in,
mm-hmm.
and then we're going to start seriously looking at fundraising. Mm-hmm. But we want to do music. We want to do singer-songwriter kind of things in a listening room situation where people can come in and hear, you know, just really come in to listen to music. There are a lot of places you can go around here to hear music, but for the most part, you're going to hear a lot of people talking in the background at the same time, and drinks clinking, and people yelling drink orders and things like that. So we want, you know, to have a place where the fans can really tune into the artists. In fact, we're even thinking about having some electric groups in to unplug and do acoustic sets. We thought that would be a lot of fun, something that their fans don't get to hear very often. We want to do comedy. We'd like to have some stand-up. We'd like to have sketch comedy. There's a sketch comedy in town called, Happy Time Explosion Show. And they've done three different evenings of sketch comedy over the past maybe 2 years. And very funny stuff. So, you know, maybe we could give them a home.
Well, Creative Works was actually an inspiration in putting this podcast together. Russell Frost, who's involved with Creative Works.
Yes, Russell's the chair.
Okay.
Yeah, he does a great job.
The grand poobah, then.
Yes.
He and I, out of a couple conversations about a year ago, ended up in a phone call one night where he was like, "Why don't you do a podcast?" Mm. And I was like, maybe I will. And then, lo and behold. So, I've always had sort of that in the back of my mind. But I've never known much about Creative Works. It was just sort of, I think Russell was working on it at that time. And I was in a place where I, for some reason, had the capacity to start doing something. And he kind of encouraged it from that perspective. And then that was sort of where the involvement ended.
And I never will play the Wild Rover no more. And it's no, nay, never. No, nay, never, no more will I play the Wild Rover. No, never, no more.
One other thing I wanted to touch on was music. Our reach is mostly Lancaster, but there's some people who listen to this podcast who are outside of the area and know that I sing and play guitar in Fire in the Glen,
right?
Local Celtic duo with Tom Knapp, the fiddler. But a lot of people might not know that you were actually you preceded me in that group for about 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, about six, I think.
I get the benefit from that now, from all that hard work when things weren't quite as well known. So, how did you get into Fire in the Glen?
I went down to hear Tom and his former partner, John Varner, who was the Fire in the Glen 1.0, I guess is
right,
how they referred
right.
to it. But I heard him. And I had always loved Irish music when I was a kid. For some reason, the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem,
interesting.
When I was in high school and college, really held a lot of appeal for me. I'm not Irish. I'm really Scottish more than anything else. But I just loved those songs. And I played them over and over again and knew a lot of them. And I had played guitar and for folk music back in the day. And my son got interested in bluegrass. So I accompanied him on bluegrass guitar, rhythm guitar. I'm a rhythm guitarist. I'm really not a great picker at all. But John was looking to leave the group, and I said to Tom, I said, well, could I audition, whatever? So I did, and, we seemed to get along well, and we'd known each other before. Uh-huh. And so we just got together and started doing it, and it was fun, and I brought a lot more of the old Irish songs, the old Clancy sure. Brothers style songs into our set list, and Tom took care of the tunes.
Absolutely.
Put together great tune sets. And and we just had a great time. Unfortunately, what finally ended our partnership, which was a good thing for you, but I got involved with theater around that time. Right. And St. Patrick's Day was a time where we would just get the one day of the year, right, when we would get gig after gig.
Sure.
And I knew I was going to be in rehearsal that entire week for Mother Courage. I was doing the cook in Mother Courage. And I went to him a couple months before, I think, and said, you know what, Tom? I said, I'm just not going to be able to do this. And I said, I think you're just going to have to find another partner, because I was getting more and more involved in the theater.
Yeah.
And so then he found you across the street.
Yes.
Yeah.
We had actually known each other for a couple years, but I probably hung out with him two or three times. Uh-huh. We would occasionally have parties with music over here. And my wife and his wife actually met first on the street, mm-hmm. just sort of a welcome to the neighborhood, like,
right.
Hi, how you doing? And mm-hmm. and then he knew I played music, and I was playing folk music with another mm-hmm. band, and he called and said, would you be interested? He said, if you can learn 2 hours of Irish music in 2 months, we can make a lot of money. And I was like, that sounds like a challenge I'd be willing to take on. Well, one of our most popular songs, and a song that I had the privilege of singing on the last Fire in the Glen CD, is I'd Stop Drinking.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a Chet Williamson original. So I thank you for that as well.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's certainly one of those songs that just always, it's always a crowd pleaser.
Yeah.
That's good fun.
I drink because I'm happy, and I drink because I'm sad. I drink because I'm miserable, I drink because I'm glad. And when they say that there's 12 steps to stop drinking today, I kick them down the 12 steps that lead to Galway Bay. Oh, I'd stop drinking if I could find another way. If I could find another way. If I could find another way. I'd stop drinking if I could find another way. If I could find another way to get it down.
What's the future hold?
What do you mean, in general? I'd say massive global warming, terrible climate change, death and destruction for all of us.
That's great.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
Something I ask musical guests on Around the Wood Stove is for a handful of Desert Island discs. I'd like to ask you that, though. But let's turn it to Desert Island books.
Wow. Oh, Desert Island books?
Yeah.
Oh, that's harder.
You got three books you can take with you.
Well, actually...
And there's no Kindle.
Damn. Okay. But actually, I was on Desert Island Discs, the one that Ellen Hughes did for WITF. Yeah. And she... You get a book. You get to take one book along, too. And it would still be the same book. And it would be Proust's Remembrance of Things Past, which isn't called that anymore. It's now called Time... Oh, what the hell? I forget. But I would take that one because I haven't read it, and I really want to read it, and I know that the only chance I'll ever get to read it is if I'm stuck on a desert island with that and nothing else. It's just that kind of thing.
Well, thanks very much for doing this. This has been
Jason.
Has been great, and a great expansion of the podcast into the other performing arts.
Good.
So I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Around the Wood Stove is a production of the Wood Stove House with inspiration from the creative works of Lancaster. Our theme song is the old-time traditional tune Buck Dancer's Choice, performed by Jeff Sims and myself, Jason Mundock. Find us on the web at woodstovehouse.com.
But, how do you deal with it when it's inside your own body? No.